Recordings have started.
Thank you. Good morning, good afternoon, and good evening, and welcome to the review of all rights protection mechanisms, RPMs, and all GTLD PDP working group call held on Wednesday, the 30th of May, 2018 at 1200 UTC. In the interest of time, there will be no roll call. Attendance will be taken by the WebEx room. If you are only on the audio bridge, could you please let yourselves be known now?
This is Jeff Newman.
Thank you, Jeff. I would like to remind all participants to please state your name before speaking for transcription purposes, and to please keep your phones and microphones on mute when not speaking to avoid any background noise. With this, I will turn it over to Phil Corwin. Please begin.
Yeah, thank you. Phil here. Welcome back, everyone. We've been away for 2 weeks. We skipped two meetings because of other events going on. Now we're back with our APAC time call. Any change in statement of interest from anyone? All right, and our agenda is to discuss quantitative data from Professor Tushnet's research that can be used to address document subteam questions about the 250 responses received and 58 respondent prevailed cases. And there's a link to a Dropbox document. And then after that, we're going to discuss some planning for ICANN 62 in Panama, where we have three sessions scheduled at the meeting. So anyone wish to kick off the discussion about the professor's research? Is the professor with us today? I don't...
Hello, Phil. It's Julie Hedlund from staff. Yes. She was expected to join. We did confirm with her previously that she was available at this time, although I don't think I see her on the call. Just checking again. No, I don't see her at this moment.
Can someone email it? My understanding was that she was going to take the lead on this call. Is
yes,
that correct?
That was the staff understanding, and that is what we had confirmed with her. So I will go ahead and try to get in touch with her.
All right. Let's see what we can do here. I apologize to all for the delay, but our expectation was the professor would lead the discussion here.
Yeah, thank you, Phil. This is Julie Hedlund again. I do see that she had responded to a message on the list just late yesterday, so she's certainly active in the discussion. Let me go ahead and get in touch right now.
Okay.
Would it be helpful in the meantime if staff provided a little bit of an introduction?
Yeah, why don't we go ahead and do that? That would be very helpful. Get some background in anticipation of Professor joining.
Okay, great. Thank you. I think that Mary had wanted to give a little bit of an intro, but I don't know if she has joined quite yet. Let me get this message off to Rebecca, and then we can talk through the intro. While we're waiting for Mary, I think Barry might be able to give us a little bit of an intro. Barry, please go ahead.
Thank you, Barry Cobb, for the record. So the intent for today's agenda was basically to understand what the working groups and or the subteams' next steps are going to be as it related to Professor Tushnet's data set. As you'll recall, we divided into our three sub-teams a few months ago, one of them being the document sub-team, the second being the providers sub-team, and the third being the practitioners. Within the document sub-team, which was basically began with the foundation document that was identifying different aspects or charter questions, that sub-team had also created an additional column on that document trying to identify what quantitative types of data sets might be available to help answer some of those charter questions, in addition to some prior analysis that staff had done as it related to the 780 or so URS cases up to 2017, which I think equated to about 850 or so domain names across those cases. More specifically, when the document subteam was wrapping up its effort, it was about the time that Professor Tushnet had sent her coding exercise, which was reviewed briefly over the last call. And so today's kind of discussion is to understand what those next steps should be and whether how that coding exercise can help complete or help better inform some of the charter questions. And I do have a little bit more information as it relates to the subteam or from the document subteam, but that the working group should also make a decision as to how this data can be used and should we split apart back into our subteams to complete the exercise or continue forward as the full working group. And I'll note that Rebecca's coding data set, there were also several, I can't remember how many, I'm going to say four or five potential areas from the providers subteam where this data might help them in completing the questions that have been submitted to them. I'm not as intimate with those as I was with the document subteam, but those are possible areas as well. You know, and the last thing I'll state before I turn it back over to Julie is, you know, as it relates to the agenda item, in terms of the 250 responses received and then the 58 cases where the respondent prevailed, I have already done some of this analysis. So using Rebecca's, unfortunately, it's not in a position to share. I'm still confirming the data that or the summary results of that data. And hopefully we can send that out early next week for either the full working group or if the working group decides to go to a sub-team first and chew on that data first before taking it back to the working group. But the responses, we were able to look at those a little bit more in depth based on that coding exercise. They had decided or they had coded that, you know, was there a response received? If yes, was it within 14 days? If not within 14 days, was there a response within 6 months? And were there any requests for extensions? And so that definitely was very useful in understanding how the responses occurred. And more importantly, what it turned out is in terms of the 58 cases where the respondent prevailed, just about half of them, there was no response. So that even creates that small subset just a little bit smaller in terms of the cases that we would review, which is really around the area of, what is it? Let me pull it up on the document. Which as it relates to the standard of proof and defenses around URS procedures 5.7 and 5.8. Which is where some of that analysis will occur. And then lastly, I'll also point out as it relates to Rebecca's research, and I had mentioned this when it was being introduced on the call, There's one particular part of that analysis which talks about the domain's disposition, trying to understand what its current state is and what happened to it after the case had after the determination had been made. Did in fact the domain get suspended, and then more importantly, what happened to the domain after the suspension? Unfortunately, the original Whois data that I had provided to them was not a current query, but a last known record, which threw off the actual results. In the meantime, I've done a fresh query against Whois. I was able to acquire about 1,400 of them from an automated perspective, and then I had to manually go fetch the other 400. But this new data set will first tell us whether the name is registered or not. And then after that, I've gone through in the details to figure out, is the name under suspension, which is kind of the biggest group of the domains. But then to understand of those that aren't suspended, basically trying to tag them or categorize them into queues, whether the domain is protected under brand protection, DPML, or whether the original registrant is using the name. And I'm still working on cleaning out that data. And then finally, having done that exercise, there were two things to note. One was that so far, and again, this is preliminary results, and we'll share this soon, but as one example, I only found one instance where the domain that the complainant prevailed, went through suspension, eventually became available or was deleted and available for registration, and the original registrant re-registered the name. But in understanding that exercise, I started to notice that there were also duplicate domains that had been, that had two URS cases filed against it. Some of which where the domain is, or the case that was first filed, it was either withdrawn or the claim was denied for whatever reason, and that the trademark owner then resubmitted the claim. And then another primary use case is that the trademark owner prevailed in the original case, but the domain was deleted. And then it was re-registered by a different registrant, and another URS case was filed against the same name. There were about 20 domains where that happened. So that's something that I don't think any of us originally had planned to use or look at, but it does look like it might be another useful data set for us to look at. So sorry for rambling so long. Like I said, I'm just trying to confirm and validate some of the summary charts that are, or summary pivot tables that are being presented. I'm hopeful that we can share that with the working group early next week. And again, kind of the decision on the table is how should we proceed with the use of this data set, either at the working group level or at the sub-team level, and go from there. So I hope that was helpful. Thank you.
Hi, Phil. This is Kathy. May I join the queue?
Yeah, sure, Kathy. Before you speak, I just wanted to ask a follow-up question of Barry. You available, Barry?
Yes, sir.
Yeah. So there were about, my recollection, there were about 900 total URS cases filed to date, correct?
I believe it's 827.
Oh, 827.
To close.
Okay. So out of those 820 cases, there were responses in about 250, correct? Which would be about 30% of all the cases filed?
Yes.
Okay. And in all of the 826 cases, the respondent prevailed in 58, and from what you just said, half of those respondent prevailed cases came in cases where there was no response.
That is correct.
So the 58 is not just a subset of the 250, but of all the cases. So then the question before us would be what conclusions from that high-level data and additional data from the research could be used to draw any conclusions about the operation of the URS, the I guess the sufficiency of the response time, the neutrality of the objectiveness of the determinations, all of that. But without the professor here to get further into the weeds, it's hard to know what to do with that. So far as whether conclusions to be drawn from the research should be discussed within the full group or by a sub-team, we've only got 20 people on this call. I'm not sure that we can make that decision for the full working group. We may have to take it to the email list. Just checking to see. All right, so we still don't have the professor with us. Go ahead, Kathy.
Great. Thanks. And, Barry, thanks for the introduction. At the very beginning of your introduction, you said something that sounded really interesting, and I kind of missed it in passing. I think you said that there was, that in the long questions created, the questions created by either the providers or practitioners sub-teams, that there might be answers in the data that Rebecca provided. I'm not sure we want to go through it now, but if that's the case, would you have the time to kind of go through and help both, you know, because those questions are now kind of up at the working group level, help the working group see where those answers might lie, or at least the data might lie to some of those questions that we've been asking. That would be great. Thank you.
Thank you, Kathy. That is what staff has done in preparation. It wasn't the practitioners at all. I don't believe there was any potential data sets, at least from my perspective in our cursory review, where any of Professor Tushnet's data might be useful for them. But there were four or five, again, I can't remember what they were, exactly how many for the providers, because there were some pretty detailed questions to the providers, and I believe their general response was that they would need to review through all of the cases to accurately respond to that. So it's hopeful that in those four or five instances where this data may be helpful, that the providers could potentially use the data to try to get to the answer that that particular sub-team was looking for. And yes, I don't think we're prepared to walk through those on today's call, but we can certainly make it a part of the next agenda item to highlight those potential areas that the providers could use the data for.
Or that maybe we could use the data for directly. I'm not sure the providers have access to this material or want to go through it. And it may be something we can answer just directly by accessing the data.
Well, I believe that the Dropbox link is available to everyone, so they would have access to it. And again, I'm not intimate with it. The exact questions being asked. What I will note that it still will take time for some analysis and maybe to find the appropriate coding columns whereby we can create a pivot table to find some relationship among the data to help answer that question. You know, there's several summary tabs in Professor Tushnet's data set that may be able to answer some of those, but I suspect that there will be some manual analysis, and again, pivot tables, I love pivot tables, that may need to be built to help inform the providers to answer those or the working group, whichever direction.
Okay, did you have anything further, Kathy?
off mute. Not at all. I appreciate Barry's response.
All right. I see a hand up from George Kirikos. Go ahead, please.
George Kirikos for the transcript. Yeah, I noticed on the there are other questions that we can answer with this data if it's properly collated. For example, in the cases by respondent country tab, we can see that the top 15 countries of the U.S. respondents was listed, with China being 252 cases, the United States of America 159. But then we see how a bunch of non-English speaking countries, some of them are English speaking, for example, Canada and Australia, et cetera. But if we look at, for example, the default rate for non-English speaking countries and see how that varies against English speaking countries, that can help answer some of these language related questions, and also even just the success rate where they do respond, because if you're in a race but you're starting 20 meters behind because your native language is in English, then that puts you at a disadvantage. Thank you. So it's just a matter of collating the data appropriately to answer some of these other questions. Thank you.
Okay. I just lost my computer. Something just happened to my desktop, and it's restarting, which has never happened before. I don't know if there was a brief power outage or what, but I'm flying blind at the moment. I can't see a thing.
Thank you, Phil. This is Julie Hedlund from staff. We do not currently have any hands up at the moment.
And okay. I can wander off somewhere else and maybe get on another. This is going to take me a moment, I'm afraid.
Hey, Phil, this is Jeff Newman. Can I just get in the queue real quick? And I could
Jeff, go ahead, because got a situation here where...
I've got to
get online on a different machine. I'm putting myself on speaker and listening right now. And, Kathy, maybe I can hand off to you for a moment while I get back online. And go ahead, Jeff.
Thanks. I'm just trying to, so while this data is interesting for data purposes, I'm still trying to figure out why or how we're trying to use it. I think George went over a theory on the non-English speakers, which, again, the first thing that comes to my mind is, well, are the strings themselves English words being applied for non-English speakers? So I just want to make sure that we don't just jump to conclusions based on raw data that we, you know, we don't even have a working theories or things that we're trying to prove or disprove. We just have a whole bunch of data in front of us, and I'm just worried about, you know, taking months to look at data without kind of any just context or background of what we're trying to look for or why this data, you know, it's great that someone got the data, but, I mean, without discussions beforehand as to why we think the data is useful or what it's useful for, what we're trying to prove or disprove or theories or anything like that, I'm just not sure what we're going to do with a whole bunch of data dropped in our lap. But that's just a general concern. Thanks.
This is Greg Chatton. Can I get in the queue, please? I'm on audio only.
Sure. Can everybody hear me? This is Kathy, and I think, and I'm driving, so, but I think Phil just handed this over to me. I just wanted to respond to Jeff briefly that, you know, that this is, you know, these are the questions that we are considering. We have been given, we have had a lot of data dropped in our last, very comprehensive data. It involves every case up to a certain point. And I just wanted to add there's a certain number of withdrawals as well. About 7% of the cases have been withdrawn, and to me that's very interesting as well. So, you know, we have a lot of questions. We have a lot of data. How can we, my thought would be, how can we merge it? Greg, go ahead, please.
Thanks. Greg Chatton for the record. Partially to respond to Jeff, I think there are, I don't know that the working group has has theories, but it seems to me that there are individual members have theories that they would like to try to prove using this data. So it'll be interesting to see how that plays out. I think we need to be careful with the inferences that we draw from the data and extrapolating. For instance, whether the default rate for non-English speakers has anything to do with their language capacity is not something that can be drawn from this data. We need to know why they defaulted. There are a number of alternate theories one could provide, including the fact that the people from non-English speaking countries have a higher rate of cyber squatting, and therefore their cases are dead losers and they decided not to try to defend themselves. That is at least as viable a theory as the idea that they were just poor schmucks who were handicapped by the inability to deal with English, which you may or may not have been an issue. We just don't know. So trying to pretend that we know things we don't know because there's data that has certain numbers is something that we need to avoid. Otherwise, we're just going to be merrily kind of abusing the data, and that's something we need to watch out for. Thanks.
Yeah, this is Phil. Kathy, I appreciate your briefly taking over while I switched machines due to my technical issue. I'm back on. Thank you, Jeff and Greg, for those comments. I think, we need to be very careful about only drawing conclusions that flow naturally from the data and not trying to pull things out of it that aren't clearly supported. And I see something in the chat on this. Without the we're half an hour into the call. The professor's not with us. We were expecting her to lead the discussion and tell us what she thought might what conclusions might credibly be drawn or at least looked at, what questions could be looked at based upon this data. And she's not with us. And rather than go too far with speculation based on very little information here.
I have my hand up.
Who's that?
This is Scott. I do have my hand up.
I'll get to you in a second, Scott.
Okay.
I don't know how long we want to go with this discussion today. Maybe we can talk about what's the best way to deal with this. Certainly we don't want to be spending months on this. I think we, my own view, strictly personal view out there for discussion, is that we, and we'll be having another data sub-team call, a long one later today where we may get into this a lot more. I don't want to preempt that call, but perhaps that's the group that should be looking at this and reporting back to the full working group in a rather short period of time, the next few weeks, as to what conclusions relevant to the questions we have regarding providers can be credibly drawn from the professor's data. So with that, I'll stop and recognize Scott. Scott, go ahead. Scott Austin, if you're on mute, unmute yourself.
Yeah, I'm sorry. I just had to get through the various items on my phone. Back to it. Anyway, my questions, and perhaps Barry could address that because I know he's been working with the professor to a certain extent and looking at this a lot. I noted there are a series of language cases, and as much as George has offered his theory, apparently some folks either requested that the analysis be done or the decision be done in their language, but I wasn't sure exactly what the list of language cases meant. If the string was in a particular language or affected by a particular language, or if those were cases where either the complainant or respondent had asked for the decision to be put into a language other than English. And that's one question. second question is, in the summary tables, there are references to default. This is in the count case number, lower right-hand corner. Default and default final slash final and then final. And I just wondered how those distinctions were made, if there were really only 15 cases where there was a final decision in the instance of a default, or there were 566 default cases where no final decision was rendered. I just wanted to determine what that distinction was. And if Barry can speak to that, great. Otherwise, I guess I'll wait until the professor breaks it down. Thanks.
Yeah, Barry, did you have a response on that?
Yes, sir. Thank you, Scott. So, I can't speak 100% for Rebecca's coding exercise. So, but I'll offer up at least what I've observed thus far. So, the one tab as it related to the country is only from the registrant's location, and I don't think that has any much more detailed data as to beyond just the location of the registrant. I've combed through a lot of cases, and the only two providers that I see where cases were in a language other than English were from MFSD or MFSD and ADNDRC. I don't think I've come across one case from Forum that had that wasn't in English. That said, I'd hate to go any further as to make any other kind of observation about how the providers and or the examiners were dealing with the respondents in that regard. As it relates to the second part of your question, and I'm not sure exactly what you were looking at, but the same premise, or I guess the same columns of data are similar from the original data set that I have scraped off of the providers and that we did some of our initial analysis and review of the charts back several ICANN meetings ago. And that's essentially how they're displayed on the provider's site. In essence, they will provide two kinds of status as it relates to the particular cases. And what's the ultimate outcome or the result? And that's either the claim was denied or the domain was suspended or basically the case was withdrawn. And then you basically then have the determination, and anywhere where it lists default, essentially there was no response, there was no request for an extension, and it was a default outcome or determination that ultimately resulted in the domain being suspended and or the claim denied. In cases where there's a final, it typically meant that there was a response to that particular case, and that could have happened within the 14 days or even within the six month period. And that was that determination code. But in essence, and then I think there's a few that are default final, and then there's an additional column that also highlights appeals. But at the end of the day, those types of codes really came from the provider's site themselves, and in essence, when you're looking at Professor Tushnet's spreadsheet, the basic case information was the data that I had originally that staff had originally scraped off of the provider websites.
Great. Thank you, Barry.
Okay. All right. And, Scott, I assume that's an old hand up there. So,
just one follow-up question to what Barry mentioned.
Okay.
Because I was on the practitioner group, and I know one of the things we asked in our survey questions was regarding the use of an appeal within the six-month period. I just wondered, in the spreadsheet itself, Barry, is there a place, and forgive me if it's obvious, but is there a place where that particular type of case has been highlighted where there was an appeal within the six-month period? And that's my last question.
Thank you, Scott. I guess I had missed that was a specific question within the practitioner's one. It was also listed on the document subteam, and we did do an analysis. So there were 14 appeals, and that was sent. Basically, it was a part of the summary report that the document subteam, and that Brian Beckham was our subteam chair for that. But they were basically 14 appeals. Seven were related to the .email gtld. And there's other details that I don't have right in front of me about those 14 appeals. But we analyzed those 14 cases and tried to basically compare the original case to the appeal, understand what the responses were like. But we didn't dive into the aspects about any of the three prongs or the three elements of to prove within those cases, other than highlighting what it was and then the ultimate determination. So there is already a summary of those appeals completed. What I can answer for you is whether that will address the question that you your subteam had created.
Well, my question was simpler. It was just whether or not any of those appeals are singled out and reflected in Professor Tushnet's coding exercise, as you referenced it. Here.
They are highlighted, and that is column 'Alpha Papa AP, and it'll basically either be coded as not applicable or successful or unsuccessful. And then column 'Alpha Quebec AQ will have a link to that particular appeal.
Great, thank you.
Okay, thank you, Scott. Thank you, Barry. I'm going to go through some of the comments put in the chat and then maybe wrap up this discussion where we're limited. From George N., he agreed with Jeff. He thinks just looking at the data by itself doesn't help without a broader context. In particular, the data has some assumptions and codings built into it that may or may not be accurate. So if we're going to look at the data, we need to consider the professor's underlying assumptions. And, of course, we need the professor to do that. I'm editorializing a bit as I read this. And then Mary Wong stated, as Barry noted, it's up for the working group to decide which parts of the data and how is relevant to the scope of our work. Rebecca's research assistant has done a lot of work, but it's entirely her research, and she has kindly provided it to us in full. Doesn't mean it's all directly relevant to our work, is why some may be very useful, but perhaps not all of it. And then Mary continues, some of it seems very relevant to the document subteam, and then she goes on, the other two subteams may wish to see if any of the data can supplement as quantitative measures responses received from providers or practitioners. And I'll editorialize here. Of course, we're waiting for those responses. So I'm going to suggest we have very extensive research done by Professor Tushnet that is not a working group document. It's something that a working group member has developed on her own and submitted to the working group to consider whether all or part of it can be useful to our work in drawing any conclusions and helping to answer our revised charter questions regarding the URS. It's definitely relevant to the document subteam, some parts of the research may have some relevance to the work of the providers and practitioners subteam. So given that we don't have the professor available to answer questions and give us her personal view as to what portions of this research may be relevant to answering our questions, I'm going to suggest, unless there's a lot of people who want to continue talking about this at a high level, that I will discuss this with my two co-chairs, one of whom is on the call but not very able to talk, about the best way to proceed. I'm thinking the best way to proceed may be to invite members of the three URS subteams who wish to be involved to engage with the professor and report back to the full working group by a designated deadline, and I'm thinking that deadline should be no later than the Panama meeting, what useful conclusions they think may be drawn from the research. That would give us 3-4 weeks to for that small group to consult with the professor and bring something back to the full working group for consideration, because we do expect to have answers to all the practitioners' questions back before the Panama meeting, and hopefully all, but if not almost all, of the answers back from the providers. And so we want this to be fed in at the same time. We can't be waiting months later on views as to what conclusions can be drawn from the research. Any comments on that? I think we'll probably take this first to the co-chairs and then come back to the full list with a proposal of how to proceed on dealing with the Professor Tushnet's research and deciding its relevance, if any, to answering our questions. Any comments on procedure for dealing with the research? All right. I don't see any hands up. I want to correct. I made a misstatement a little while ago. The data subteam call today will not be dealing with this research. That's a call for members of the data subteam to interact with the analysis group, which has been selected to conduct the data survey on the clearinghouse claims notices and Sunrise, and assist analysis group in teeing up those questions and getting that survey out as soon as possible now that they've been contracted to get that work back to us. We're hoping by midsummer. So that's the purpose of that call today. So unless there's other comments now on the Harvard Law School research, I'm going to going once, going twice. We're going to switch to a quick discussion of ICANN 62 planning, look to staff to bring us up to date as to where things stand, briefly discuss it, and end this call early in view of the fact that the person we had hoped to engage with for most of this call is not on the call. So let's proceed to ICANN 62 discussion. Who wants to speak to that from staff to bring us an update?
Hi, Phil. This is Julie Hedlund from staff. I can speak to that. We will have sorry, I should have brought this up beforehand, but we will have several sessions at ICANN 62, and although that full schedule is not up yet, staff can tell you when those will be occurring. So they are three different sessions, and sorry, momentarily, let me just get to those. We have on Wednesday, that's the 27th of June, we have the first of three sessions. That will be from 10:30 to noon on that day. And then moving to Thursday, the 28th, we have two sessions that follow each other. one from 9 to 10:15, and one from 10:30 to noon. And staff will go ahead and send out with notes from this call that information as well. And staff are working with the co-chairs on the agenda for or program for each of those sessions.
Yeah, Julie, I thought we had picked up a Monday afternoon slot. Have we been bumped from that?
Let me check that again. I do not think there's a Monday afternoon slot. And I'm looking at that. No, I think the final determination was that what I had just mentioned to you, I think the Monday afternoon ended up clashing. It would have clashed with the cross-community session on geographic names. I see that is in an afternoon slot.
All right. So we're very backloaded. We're at the tail end of the Panama meeting, which is unfortunate, but there's nothing we can do about it.
Right. Unfortunately, the schedule set. As usual, there were, several different conflicts and sort of trading back and forth, and this is what we ended up with.
Okay. We haven't decided what we're going to use those three sessions for yet. We have committed that one of them is going to be talking about procedural issues going forward in our final for the second half of the year leading up to publication of our initial report. We'll decide what the substance of the other two will be as we approach it. Did anyone want to weigh in now on the Panama schedule or ideas for what we should be focusing on in Panama, given that we think we're going to have all the practitioner questions answers back by then, and hopefully almost all of the providers' responses. So that's the likely focus of our substantive sessions in Panama, to review those responses and discuss what, if any, conclusions can be drawn from them.
Hey, Phil, John McElwain.
Hi, John.
Get in the queue.
Yeah, go ahead, John. You're number one.
So as we've discussed on this call previously, do we still have planned a session to talk about process and scoping and going forward, how we're going to produce the interim and final report? Thanks.
Yeah, John, I just said that. We plan to devote one of the three sessions in Panama to discussing how to operate procedurally to be productive and constructive as possible in the second half of this year while we're moving toward developing an initial report.
Okay, thanks.
So the answer is yes. All right, well, I have that's the schedule for Panama, so if you're going to Panama, please don't schedule leaving too early on Thursday, because we're going to be in meetings up to noon on Thursday of the final day in Panama, right up to checkout time. Maybe we can get late departures, those of us on the working group. The only other thing I'd say, I'd like staff to review the attendance list of this new call time versus the previous call time we were using for APAC calls. I have to say, having only, I thought this time was fairly, certainly very friendly for European members of the working group, and, reasonable for East Coast and Midwest U.S. members, not so great for Pacific Coast members, but I'd like to know what the attendance of prior calls at this time have been compared to the prior APAC time, because it seems to me we have very particularly low attendance on this call. I'm not sure if that's because it's a holiday week or coming off a holiday weekend in the U.S. or what, but we had hoped to get greater attendance using this time. And that doesn't seem to be happening. So this co-chair would like some feedback on how that's working out. Does anyone else have anything they want to bring up before we adjourn the call and give you back 36 minutes of your life? Well, thank you. I'm sorry we couldn't get deeper into this today, but the speaker we were expecting on the call is not with us. We're going to take the discussion of how to proceed procedurally with analyzing the professor's research. We'll bring it back to the full working group list after the co-chairs have some discussion among themselves in regard to that. And thank you all for attending. Bye.
Thanks, everyone. Thanks for joining. Thanks so much, Phil, for chairing. Appreciate it.
Thank you. That concludes today's conference. Please remember to disconnect all lines and have a wonderful rest of your day.